So thank you for showing up for my talk. Well, what am I going to talk about? It's basically written on the screen there. I'm working for Arcos. Arcos is a French company based in, well, not directly in, but near Paris. And we are making toys for boys. Basically, that's it. So the company is doing basically multimedia devices with a strong focus on video recording and video playback, and with a strong emphasis also on having really portable mobile multimedia devices. So what I'm going to talk about is the making of a device that we did during the last 2 years. It is in some aspects not really a successor, but a device similar to the Sharp Zorus in some aspects, because we are using Qt Embedded and Qtopia for the development or for the device. That's the software stack we are running on it. We're running it on, and also the underlying Linux system is quite similar to what is on the Zorus. Apart from a few minor adjustments that we have to make, of course, to make the Linux system aware of the special hardware that we are using. So, to get into the tune, what is this device anyway? Chris Schlegel told me yesterday evening that it's quite hard to spot when you're going to, for example, Fry's or Best Buy or Circuit City in the States somewhere. They have a few of our devices, but not so many of the PMA 400. So I'm going to give you a short introduction what it is. Basically, that's it. Okay, that doesn't reveal a lot, of course. So going to show you a little bit more, tell you a little bit more. So what is it? It is a video and music player, as it says. And when I say it's a video and music player, then everybody can connect something to what is a music player. Basically, you all know what an iPod is, so you can play back MP3s, of course, also all kind of audio files. Then you would expect to have something on it like a media player application that can also have playlists that is in a way sophisticated enough to show you album art if you have integrated it into your IE3 text, stuff like that. Okay, everybody knows what that is. About portable video players, well, most of the MP3 players that are sold on the market, they are basically flash-based. They have just a few megabytes of storage capacity, unless you really have some that are equipped with a hard drive. And then the hard drive capacity ranges from basically 4 gigabytes to 20 or even 100 gigabytes. You can store a hell of a lot of music on that. And of course, you also can store video on that. But what does it mean, video? There's another hell of a lot of video formats out there. The most common one basically being DivX, which is just another name for MP4 video with MP3 audio in a very strange container file format called AVI that Microsoft invented some when, oh, I don't know, it's been quite a long time. I show you that they are sorry about that, because it's just a silly point. Okay, so I need to kick it after a few seconds that it doesn't produce you. So that's a video player, but then you have to find what is in this file. It's MP4, but what resolution are we talking about? If you can play back video clips on a mobile phone, then it is basically something like 174 pixels by 120 pixels. That's not something you would use to watch a real movie. You can basically bear it for a video clip, for a music video, yes, it might work, or for a video telephone, that's also okay, but you wouldn't want to watch Star Wars with that quality. So it must be something else. And what we're especially good in is making video players, portable video players, where you can really play back material that you can easily also watch on the computer screen or on your TV screen at home, because it's near DVD quality. So that's what I mean with play and make video. Okay, obviously there is a hard drive inside, because where else would you store content in with these amounts of data? So the thing is also a portable hard drive, meaning you have a USB 2 connector. You can hook it up to your laptop and store up to 30 gigabytes of data on it. So it makes it a quite handy device, I think, even if it did nothing else. But then it would be quite a very expensive portable hard drive. What else do we have? It's a photo wallet. Photo wallet means you can hook it up to your digital camera and synchronize the photos that you have on your digital camera, stored on the hard drive. There's an integrated photo viewer, image viewer, that you can use that to basically make or check whether the files or the images that you did are crisp. Can decide to just delete them immediately or to keep them. And since the device can also connect to a TV, you can even use it to make small ad hoc presentations for your friends after a holiday trip, for example. Interestingly, it's also a digital video recorder, and it's really a digital video recorder because you can hook it up to any analog video signal, and it's then going to record in a It's a webpad. It means you have a kind of internet connectivity on it, and there's a browser on it. You have an email program, so you have really the basic internet connectivity that you also have on your desktop computer or laptop. And then it's also a PDA. Well, as I said, it runs Utopia, so there are the basic personal information management applications there, like a date book, like an address book, and so on and so on. Okay, more specific about the audio, we support MP3, of course. No manufacturer has ever made a digital portable music player without MP3 support and managed to make it a success. Sony tried, but they failed miserably. You remember the thing that Sony did? They made a player that was not able to play back MP3, but a format called A-Track that they invented themselves. And to accommodate for that, or to compensate for that, they gave the users an application that would transcode all their MP3 files into A-Track and store them on the device. But that was basically a stupid idea, because if you want to transfer large amounts of files, like 10,000 files or so, it's going to take a whole night, just because transcoding takes so long. So it wasn't really successful. Okay, MP4, video playback with MP3 sound or PCM sound, or like you mentioned that, it's a format called DivX. Specifically, it is DivX 4 or DivX 5. Those are not really different, it's just that DivX networks change the specification basically to allow for higher resolution or for other MPEG-4 encoding tools like advanced profiles, stuff like that. But basically, if you have something that can play back DivX 4 or DivX 5, you can use the files that this device is recording. And they're cheap. I mean, like $50 or so. The player itself is plugin based, meaning that you can basically make audio plugins that enable the thing to play back a lot of other audio formats, and also media formats, but there are certain limitations. And if I say you can, I mean that literally, because we publish the interface specification and also publish an SDK with the necessary libraries. So it is possible for advanced users or skilled developers to enhance the functionality of this device quite extensively within the limitations that the hardware has. We'll come to that later. We'll see that this imposes certain limitations. You can play back on the internal screen, of course, and you can also play back on TV, meaning you have a composite video output. Most TVs can use this single format as input, and if you have a nice 16:9 flat screen at your home, you can basically use this thing instead of a DVD player. Okay, photo wallet, already talked about that. There's a built-in USB 1 host, meaning with a little cable you can connect directly to a digital camera. All cameras that are just USB mass storage are directly supported because they're just hard drives. Well, seen from the computer side, it's just another disk. And since we are kind of compatible to the Sharp source, there exists this nice Qphoto2 application, which is basically just a wrapper around Qphoto2. And there you have basically support for every camera out there. That's not an application that's directly supported by our company, but we have tested it quite for some time. That's likely that we want to ship it with a software update something. Question?
The USB, it's not USB on the go, it's actually a USB to device and USB to white host.
No, it's not on the go. It is really, there are really two USB connectors in this device. We'd love to be going with just USB on the go because you have one less connector. It's always nice from the cabling point of view. Of course, also for not confusing the user too much because they never get it right which plug to use when. After some time, you manage it. No, it's the real USB 1.1 host. That means you can, for example, hook up an Ethernet adapter. We support a few. You can hook up a keyboard. You can hook up, oh yes, since there's a gaming engine on it, you can also hook up a Raspberry Pi to play games on this thing on the TV. So there's basic photo viewer inside. Already talked about that, and about the ad hoc presentations that you can make. I think it is quite handy, maybe not for the semi-professional photographers, but for the avid photographer that uses a digital camera and does a lot of pictures and wants to have a quick look at the quality of the images. Without wanting to carry around a laptop all the time, because you can much easier look about the quality or decide about the quality of the picture, basically about its crispness when you have a larger screen, because the screens that come with most digital cameras are just too small to really say if the pictures are good. WebPad built in H100 2.11b only. Of course, everyone says that. Why didn't you do B and G? There, of course, affordable in price and not so heavy on the battery, because, well, David talked about this yesterday already. Wi-Fi is really a source heavy when it comes to power consumption, and that's not a good thing for a mobile device. So we have a 11B only. It's built in. It still sucks down a lot of battery power, but it is kind of it's kind of working. Then we have an Opera web browser, which is quite fine. For a basic email, there's the Qtopia email client on it. It's not really a great application, but it works. And for example, there are quite some third-party products available also in the open source space that you can use instead. So that's not really a problem. So we see. So what's inside? Of course, there's hardware. What's on the screen right now is not exactly the hardware configuration that is really in the device that's out on the market. It is basically a draft of a device at an earlier stage of the planning. There are some differences, but the basic building blocks are there, and you will, for example, find that we have, in fact, two CPUs in this device. There's one OMA, which is a CPU, ARM-based CPU that is also quite often used on mobile phones. And there is another very special chip that is basically doing the video decoding and encoding for us. You might ask yourself, if you're a little bit into the business, why the hell did they do that? Because it's hell of a complex thing, and we really struggled to get this thing working. Trust me, at the time this thing was drafted, there wasn't anything available that could do what we wanted to achieve with just one chip. Oh, actually, there was a solution, but when we started to use it, it turned out that it was so terribly broken that we nearly killed off the whole project. Okay, what do we have? We also have 64 megabytes of SD RAM. That's quite a lot, but you need it. I will show you later why and what for. And you will also see that the second CPU, the right side, has its own 16 megabytes of SD RAM memory. And if you're a little bit familiar with the PC architecture, you will find that this is basically some kind of graphics card. The graphics card has its own CPU, its own RAM. And as you can also see, the LCD display is connected only to this secondary CPU. So basically, you have a host concept with a host CPU and a graphics CPU that is quite similar to a PC. The only thing is the bus between the two chips is unfortunately not really capable of high bandwidth data transfer. And if you look closely, there it says 16-bit. And we found out when the vendor of this chip said 16-bit, he really meant it. So you cannot do 8-bit or 32-bit data transfers over this bus. It's really 16-bit, nothing else is working. So if you want to change one byte in graphics memory, you have to read 16-bit, modify the upper or the lower half of these 16 bits, and then write it back. And you can imagine what that means if you're drawing lines or drawing images. It's,
another question?
Yeah.
The USB 2 device, the controller on the bottom, that can only see the IDE drive, not the compact flash drive?
Yes. The USB mass storage controller that is there on the lower side, that's really a dedicated thing. It has its own small CPU inside, and it is basically able to directly talk to a hard drive. There's an exclusive access to be scheduled between the CPU to hook up the Wi-Fi card. So it's not really available, but we found that this is not really a problem because what you do with the compact flash thing, you would use it to copy images from a still camera. So you can do that on a USB. Okay, about the memory layout, we have 64 megabytes. Unfortunately, we have to spend 22 of these megabytes to make a RAM disk. Now you'll probably say, these guys are crazy. They have 30 gigabytes hard drive, and they could just install Debian on it. Yeah, of course we could. I will show you afterwards why it's not really feasible to do that. To get the most out of this 22 megabytes that we set aside for the disk, we use a compressed file system, a compressed RAM file system. And to save some more memory and to speed up program launch, we use a feature that is called execute in place. Basically, that means that some of the libraries and programs in this RAM disk image are not stored compressed, but just in a linear format, and they are directly executed from there. So you don't need to copy them to the system memory and launch the program from there, because that also takes some time. Because you need to decompress it as you go. And to do all the relocation stuff. So there's basically 42 megabytes available for user programs. And now this is the answer why you wouldn't want to run from hard disk all the time if you are really looking for a portable device. If you look at the power pattern that a hard drive has when it's trying to read some data. I'm not so sure that it's really visible on the screen, but basically you can define four phases which all have their very different, very specific power consumption pattern. The first thing is you have to spin up the drive. That takes around 1.5 watts for 2.5 seconds. Then you have to read the data depending on the speed of the drive, speed of your interface. This is on average over 2 watts over a certain period of time, and even if the hard drive is idling, it's over 1 watt of power consumption. And now you have an accumulator that basically carries 7 or maybe 8 watt hours if you want to do MP3 playback over 10 hours or so. So the decision was to keep the hard drive basically shut down all of the time, and then you have to have something where you run your programs from, because you might know that every program execution on Linux is demand page. That means the Linux system makes really heavy use of the storage media, because it's just reading scale of about, I think, a few gigahertz. subscription for that, meaning that this is another $4 or $5 of the bill of materials if you also don't want to have that, of course. So about the software, it's basically Utopia 1.7, which we made some modifications to. Basically, we wrote some additional multimedia applications. Because basically the player, the multimedia player that comes with Utopia is software only. It's quite efficient. It uses FFmpeg, which is a very, very fast decoding engine. But of course, itself, it did not do encoding. And also, it has the problem that it's not so easy to implement hardware support for hardware that isn't, where the documentation is really available, because it's under a disclosure agreement. So it is, in the most times, not possible to contribute this code into a GPL or a GPL project. So that's the reason why we had to basically choose to rewrite the multimedia applications ourselves. PDAs usually do not know anything about hard drives, so there were a few things that had to be done with Utopia so that it supports that. Then we looked at the standard networking configuration that comes with Utopia and decided that it doesn't really fit with the fixed Wi-Fi card built in, because it's all based on the fact or on the assumption that the card has to be plugged before it's usable. That's not really the case with our hardware. And then we, of course, had to do a few more translations to it, because the only translation with Utopia that is really maintained is basically the English one, so the original text. There's a German translation, we looked at it and chose to basically redo it. So about the file system layout, that's also kind of it's a little special in itself, because we do not have a flash memory on the device other than for just storing the bootloader. So that means we don't really have a writable permanent memory other than the hard drive. And since the RAM disk is in compressed format, it isn't writable either. So we had to use some trickery to at least simulate something like a writable file system. What we did was basically that we copied, or not directly copied, but mirrored the file system trees that are below /etc and /alt /utopia into a tree that is in a temporary file system, defshm, and each file is then summing to the corresponding location in the cram FS, the compressed RAM file system. So you have under /dev/shm, you have something like a huge directory tree, and in each of these directories there's just basically some summings that point to files that are on the file system. So that doesn't really allow for third-party program installation. So there's a file system image on the hard drive that is just an X3 image, and that's handled by Utopia like any other external memory, like it would handle, for example, a compact flash card or the built-in circuit that is there. So why use embedded in Utopia? I mean, there are alternatives out there. For example, there's Windows CE, but there are also free alternatives like OPI. And the problem that we saw there was that, for example, Windows CE, we feared, would not give us the freedom of design that we saw that it was possible with Linux due to Valid and Victoria. And also, at the time that we looked at it, it was heavily overpriced, so it fell out of the equation for commercial reasons also. And about OP, yes, we looked at it, and we found that it was, well, quite a large stack of applications that are really doing what they are really up to the task they should be doing. The only problem that we saw was that the support mode was kind of vague. So we decided to just license Utopia from Trolltech. Because there we knew to whom we were talking to. And that's a decision that a company up to invest a couple of million of dollars into the development of such a device is not taking very lightly, basically, that what is done to be the problem. Okay. Well, how did we do it? The development was basically done in parallel on the PC and on the target device. And if you're a little bit familiar with Qt Embedded, you know that there's this nice virtual framework for application that runs on your desktop, and you can just use native code that runs on the PC and draws into this virtual frame buffer, and you can almost, if there are no other special hardware dependencies, almost run your whole application stack on the PC and also debug it on the PC, which comes in very handy because it's a much nicer environment to debug on. For example, we did use Valgrind a couple of times to track down problems in the software, and that you wouldn't want to do on a 150 megahertz online processor, even if Valgrind was available on the platform. So that was basically the development environment. The tools that we were using were naturally kind of a mixture between open source and commercial tools. Commercial tools come into the game because if you are dealing with special hardware, there is no way around the hardware, the vendor supplied tools. For example, for the processors that we used, they were both from Texas Instruments, we used a tool called Code Composer Studio. That is basically a proprietary tool by Texas Instruments, but you really need it if you want to do anything with the special processing units that are on these chips. Because both chips not only have a general purpose ARM9 or ARM7 CPU, so they're, but there's also, on both units, there's an ESP that we make use of, for example, for MP3 decoding or MP3 encoding, and also for MP4 decoding and encoding. And if we want to program these secondary cores, there's no way around the special tools there. But apart from that, for all other stuff, direct program development, only open source tools were used. GCC, of course, is a natural choice there. You cannot choose because you wanted, or because we wanted to be platform compatible with Zorus. That was one of the design goals, because we wanted to be able to stay as close to the Zorus regarding binary compatibility, and that, of course, also limited our choice for the compiler. So the compiler used there was a really, really ancient GCC 2.95.3 with some patches to make it behave properly. Build system itself is basically made for schema. I'm going to say a few words about that. And about the tools that were used. Otherwise, KDevelop did play quite a role in this because we kind of they were used to using an integrated development environments. We wanted them to have something that they could relate to, and therefore AWS really came in very handy. However, you cannot really limit the developer's choice of tools to use, and so in the end it turned out that some were using Halo, some were using Kate, some were using plain Netted because they have a certain affiliation to this editor. But most of the development, most of the tools that they use were usually taken from what is available with KDE. So the question, why QMake? Again, for those of you familiar with Qtopia, the older versions of Qtopia are meant to be developed with a tool that is called TMake, which is basically a set of postgres, if I'm not mistaken. However, when we looked at TMake, especially in conjunction with KDEVELOP, we found that the TMake support in KDEVELOP was not really up to the task. And also we found that TMake itself lacked quite heavily some of the functionality that we would like to have seen. So, of course, we looked at other alternatives and we quickly ruled out AutoConf and AutoMake because we found that these tools are really handy in environments where you have to figure out a lot of the system you're going to be running on or you're going to compile against, and that was completely fine for us, so there was no use for all the functionality. And without the functionality, there's not much use for AutoMake and AutoConf anyways. So we said, well, if we do not need this, let's look for an alternative. And since we are kind of working in a Qt environment, QMake was there, was available. And for the task, it was really good. Because since some of the developers still prefer to use not an IDE, but just an editor, while the QMake files are kind of same to edit, also with a regular editor, so we chose that. PlainMake files, yes, we can do that. We didn't want to. Now that comes the fun part, I think. What problems? I already said, something about limited processing power, I think. Of course, this is a problem. Tasks that you usually do on a PC in just a few milliseconds can take up to a second if you do not really have a fast CPU. Combined with the fact if you have a slow connection to your graphics memory, drawing of things on the screen can be quite slow. For example, you really have to look for quite intensely on reducing the paints, because while on PC you might not see them because they're just lightning fast. On an embedded device, you might actually see very very clearly that there's something is being painted that causes flickering, and usually this is uneasy on the user's eyes, so you try to avoid this. What we also found in conjunction with limited processing power is that since certain operations, like for example decoding JPEG pictures, which is was kind of mandatory for a photo wallet, takes quite a long time. You have to have these long actions interruptible some way, because, for example, the user wants to show some pictures, and after the first few lines of an image have been decoded, he decides, oh no, that's not the one that I wanted to show. And if you then has to wait another 10 seconds for the picture to decode and completely display until you can select the next picture, that's not an nice experience. So we want to have the decoding and showing process interruptible at any time. And that's just an example. There are many places where you have this situation, especially when I/O to slow devices is involved. And since Qt version 2, which we are using there, doesn't really support multi-threading, you have to do kind of a lot of trickery with entering the event loop or calling the event loop via process events directly. You are running into all kinds of funny problems because the user, of course, sometimes becomes impatient and keeps hitting on buttons or tapping with the stylus on the touch screen, and you get all kind of events and situations where you never never expect them to have. I'm quite sure that you will find David Force talk about asynchronous programming with Qt tomorrow very entertaining about this issue, about this topic. Another problem, of course, was to keep platform compatibility with Zorus meant that we had to sacrifice quite a few things. We were limited to a rather old version of the compiler, rather old versions of certain libraries, and basically had to cope with that. Also, if you're really up to optimizing the autonomy of such a device, meaning that you don't want to turn on a hard drive all of the time, or you want to have some very clever screensaver running that saves a lot of power, you have to, of course, go and modify the framework that is available quite a bit. And there's, of course, the problem of limited memory. And I think the most stunning that was, well, we have a big hard drive. There might even be 20,000 MP3s on this hard drive. There might be users who have playlists with 20,000 files and might be forced to display them in list view. Never try to use a QList view directly when you don't have enough memory for that. It's no fun. So basically, you don't want to duplicate any data that you have somewhere. For example, if you have a playlist in one application, you want this to be somewhere in shared memory. And if you want to display this playlist, you don't want to duplicate the data that you are showing inside the display elements. And since there is no model view controller or something in Qt2, we basically had to do this ourselves. There are other things that while you can in Europe generally assume that something like 320 by 240 fits on a TV screen, that's not the case in the United States. There, 320 by 190 or so is the maximum that you can do, because if you go with higher resolution, it's not visible anyway. Just take a bad TV and have a look at a high resolution computer image, you will see that you cannot read characters anymore, or you cannot read details anymore. And that, I think, was not so well done in this particular product. So, the users, the buyers, were a little bit undecided about this aspect.
Is it possible to modify the kernel, say to add an additional driver?
We published the kernel. It's on our website. You can modify it, but the problem is that you cannot boot a custom kernel on the device. That is something that we explicitly disabled for support reasons, because we did not want any unauthorized software image running on the device itself, because it is, if you're expecting to have 20, 30, 40, 50,000 users of these devices, then you really want to limit support calls. So we thought about a scheme where it was always possible for the user to easily restore the device to factory settings without having even to call customer support. And that kind of ruled out that we allowed the user to make too many modifications.
So does it check something, the bootloader or something like that?
Yeah, it's something much more sophisticated, unfortunately. So it's not a simple checksum, it's really cryptographic stuff. Okay. So if there are no more questions, then thanks again for attending my talk. And I hope you will have fun with the rest of the conference.
No, ahora me escucho. Ahora me escucho. Un poquito de ruido. Un poquito, sí. Un poquito, mira. Ahora está al máximo volumen. Prueba.
Hola, hola, sí. Sí, hola, 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 hola.
Hay más ruido que señal.
Input, volumen de rec, ya te digo. Mm-hmm. A ver si encontré el menú, el volumen de grabación, porque a lo mejor se la ha subido al tener el volumen, el micrófono.
Podría ser.
Claro. Sí, pero eso a lo mejor el que está en la key signing.
¿Bajar el volumen de grabación?
Sí, para que va a hacer la...
¿Ven que está tiene aquí mucho...?
Mal.
¿Sí?
Vale, ¿qué tal?
Hola. Hola.
¿Mucho ruido?
Sube el fondo.
Hola. Hola. Nada, nada de ruido.
Nada,
nada de ruido.
Yo de esto de salir no entiendo mucho, de bajar a 4 ohmios sería todavía peor, ¿no?
a ver, contra más ohmios es V igual a I por R, contra más ohmios.
Contra menos ohmios, más intensidad. Más intensidad,
claro, es menos. Menos mal.
¿De cuántos ohmios es este caso?
Haremos también.
¿De qué pedo?
De la entrada, de ese. ¿De cuánto había la entrada? Pienso que es de 8.
¿Pero el cable de cuánto?
El cable no lo tiene igual.
El cable sí tiene que ver. ¿Cuál es la diferencia del
cable? El cable de uno con otro no tiene una resistencia de estando en un buen C. Ese cable no es infinito, es una punta otra.
Esto no tiene impedancia.
Eso sería un BNC que tendría impedancia. Uno a otro, un
cable. El cable tiene que tener impedancia. Lo que tienes que poner es.
Tiene infinito. De...
No, que no,
no, tienes un BNC y de una punta a otra tiene que tener 50 ohmios.
Hola, hola. Sí. Hola.
Tiene que tener una punta a otra 65, pero eso tú tendrás que artificialmente meter los 65, el cable en sí mismo no lo tiene. El estándar de 65, el cable en sí mismo. Tiene que ser casi un. Tiene que ser casi un. Conductor perfecto siempre tienen que tender a eso.
Impedancia es característica de cable. Si tú pones el BNC que es 75 para encontrar bajada. A través de 35 y 25 no tiene esa forma. No necesitaría de
repente.
Entonces lo que hay que saber es que hacer que todo tenga el impedancia.
Es que todo tiene que tener impedancia en base a la que tienes que entrar. Es lo importante, es lo que se puede romper. Y eso que tiene como todo 8. La realidad es que no sé cuánto tiene.
Ya.
También la realidad es que no la están tratando por votando. Quiero decir que a lo mejor si allí ponemos 8, aquí nos llegan 12.
Podríamos preguntarles arriba a ver qué tal les digo con el cable de
la realidad. Pero esto es el cable de la realidad.
Ya. ¿Y si probamos con este cable ahí arriba? A ver,
es que
si
allí ya, 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 ya,